Tweet at TodaySOR.
Colm Tobin is with me. Good morning to you, Colm.
Morning, Sean.
And the book is called Nora Webster. I have to say, I had a wonderful weekend just gone by. I was able to read Nora Webster. I was able to watch the Ryder Cup and go to the All-Ireland Hurling Final. What was not to like about that? A very enjoyable read. How much of your own and your family's history and folklore is contained in this book?
My father died when I was 12, and I've always had it in my head that those few years afterwards were something I wanted to write about or would needed to write about. They appear in various ways in some of the novels. But it's 14 years ago now that I wrote the first chapter. I have it dated. It was in the spring of 2000. And over the last 14 years, I've been working steadily. I mean, I've been doing other things, writing other books, but every year, sort of, I've been adding to the book and thinking about ways of doing it. I didn't want to write a memoir. The reason was that it's very hard to remember silence, things not mentioned, absence, palpable absence, strangeness. And I couldn't see a way to do that. My problem was that I was going into secondary school. My father died in the summer. I was going into secondary school in September, and it was a school that he had taught in. So I knew the rooms because I used to come over from the primary school to the secondary school to wait for him. It was those sort of years where you could wander around schools, you know, and I knew every room he taught in. And now I was sitting in the room, but he wasn't there at the blackboard, you know. So I couldn't work out a way of doing it. So I thought about handing the story over to somebody else other than me, which would be a woman who has had certain things like my mother. But I mean, it isn't a portrait of my mother in any way, but someone who had to have a son like me. And so I was there in the house with myself and my younger brother, who was 4 years younger, and the three of us were there for those few years after, where it became a moment where his name almost couldn't be mentioned. It was too sad, and then it was too long afterwards, and we all sort of internalized it. And I think it's something that happens, you know. And so I worked out that if I told it from the woman's point of view, from the mother's point of view, how she was trying to cope with her life,
and how
I might be able to get a better, you know, structure for the book.
How closely does Nora Webster in the book resemble your own mother?
Well, it's almost like if you were making a tapestry and you had two sorts of wool, and one is called truth, absolute, down to the moment things that happened, and the other wool is invention. So in other words, when I needed something that didn't fit, you know, when the truth just, like, sometimes when you're looking for a detail that is from life really works, but sometimes it doesn't, and you're looking for some other detail then, and the imagination comes then in. So it's a mixture of two things. For example, where she goes to work is imagined, but the house she leaves every morning to go to work from is real.
So there is no firm, or there was no firm in Enniscorthy like the Gibneys that's
portrayed. Yes, exactly. That's invented. But the house she leaves every morning, and some of the other things that happen.
But did she have to go out to work to provide for you?
Yes, my mother went back to work and then we sort of noticed. I mean, there are things in the book that I think you'd have to have been there to know. The moment when we're watching, maybe it's even the radio, and details of, I think it's the 1969 budget come on. The most boring thing if you're a 14-year-old, and indeed if you're a widow, I mean, there's nothing in it about you. Suddenly Charlie Hoy is announcing this extraordinary increase in the widow's pension. And not only that, but he's backdating it. Now, the backdating becomes crucial because that's a big check arriving. Like, it's not just a weekly increase, it's a big check. And I think that big check came 3 years in a row.
I think
to widows
that was,
in Ireland.
There was an election in 1969, which may or may not have had something to do with
yes,
that.
Yes, but it also came in 1970. That it was there. It was Lamass's idea of all, you know, the rising tide lifts all boats. But certainly Charlie Haughey. And people always felt it was because his mother was a widow and that he knew how difficult it was to raise children under those conditions. So I remember those budgets, and I remember the difference they made in our house, for example.
We'll talk a little bit more in a few minutes, Colm, about the politics and the political atmosphere of the time. But just coming back to Nora / your mother, she seems to be an extraordinary self-contained kind of of an individual who doesn't really believe in confiding, or maybe just hasn't had the capacity to confide to other people or in other people.
I think anybody who's been through that process of losing a husband when you're in your 40s, and I've come across it with anyone else I've met, it's very difficult to handle children in a household. How much do you talk about it? How much do you leave silence? How much is the silence good? You know, just don't talk about it all the time. How much is the silence poisonous? And there's no real answer to that, you know, so that everybody, certainly in my circumstance, you know, that I didn't feel entitled to come home from school any day to say, you know, it's really tough going into those classrooms. Who would I say it to? And it would make everybody sad and make everybody wonder, are you all right? And so that you just sort of end up being a sort of loner in the school, sitting at the back on your own, without knowing why, because the year before you weren't sitting at the back on your own.
One of the very key moments, I think, in the growing up of the two boys, Donal and Cullum, yourself and your brother, presumably.
Donal and Connor.
Connor, I beg your pardon.
Yeah.
Was when you had to be, I suppose, sent into the care of an aunt because your mother, Nora, was looking after Morris in his final weeks and months. And that seemed to have weighed very greatly on you as a youngster.
Yeah, that happened, and myself and my brother, we never even mentioned it to each other. In other words, that...
Because she never got in touch with you. That was the big difficulty.
She couldn't work out what to do because, getting in touch with us, we'd then want to go home. And she couldn't bring us home because my father was in Vincent's, and, you know, he wanted her every day. And if she wasn't in the hospital, you know, she felt she was leaving him. So she just thought at least we were safe. With our aunt, as we were. But of course, safe is a funny word. We were safe, but we were obviously, you know, things, we were worried, and it affected both of us, I think, and we never talked about it.
Did you ever have a conversation? I won't say even have it out. Was it something that you felt you couldn't really broach in later life as an adult, maybe, or you just left it there?
I felt that she had done, my mother in this case, not Nora Webster, but that she had done a marvellous job, you know, and that she had gone back out to work. She had got the whole thing going. She didn't come home, you know, feeling sorry for herself, that she just built a new life, and that she was very loyal and decent to us. And, you know, we felt very loved and protected. So that coming home, I mean, it's just something I've thought about, you know, coming home years later when I went into therapy and I had to sort of deal with it. But coming home to say, why did you do that to me? It just seems to me something that I think will get you nowhere, and often misses the point that people do their best under those circumstances. Their best is never good enough, however.
The stammer was real, wasn't it?
Oh, the stammer's real, Sean. The stammer's real. I mean, ask me to say my name straight out, like blank, and I can't do it because the C sound is like a K sound and the T is a hard consonant. And anyone who was in school with me will remember. And also, I got it under control, and then I went in to take Spanish lessons in Spain, you know, and the teacher couldn't get over the fact that I was teaching English with this extraordinary stammer because, of course, I hadn't worked out all the Spanish words, how to say them, how to begin a sentence with a soft sound, how to soften my voice so that it wouldn't come out. So in the Spanish class, God, I would, you know, the whole thing would come out every day. And it took me a lot of work to do it in English, and I had to do it a second time.
She seems to be, again, the character your mother keeps sort of interchanging.
Yeah, you have to remember that there is a difference. There, you know?
Yes, of course. Yeah. But a really strong, a mulier fortis, to use that Latin phrase, or biblical one, a strong woman. And by God, you know, if she felt her youngster was being downgraded in school, she took action.
Yeah, it isn't in the book, but there was a Christian brother put me out of the, quite rightly put me out of the scholarship class. It was an extra tuition for scholarship boys. And he just said to me one day, you go home. And he was quite right. I was doing nothing. And when I arrived home, I said, why aren't you, you know, because at home now, study would be very important. And why aren't you down at the scholarship? I couldn't think of anything else to say. So he sent me home. Why did he send you home? I don't know. Well, she went down to the Christian Brothers and caused havoc. You know, I mean, she was very formidable in that sense if she was defending you. Often, I have to say, you know, you wish she would stay home and not do that sometimes.
Our parents tend to embarrass us, don't they?
Yeah.
And so that was sort of part of the personal relationship and how she was the caring mother. But she found a great outlet in music, the Gramophone Society. Again, I think there are wonderful layers of the local town being shown there, the hierarchy of membership and who was who. But you clearly know your music. You know your Mahler from your Mozart and your Beethoven from your Bach.
I do a bit, but people talk about those country towns as being places where nothing much happened. But on Thursday nights in Enniscorthy, people came to Murphy Flood's hotel and they would bring in a stereo, literally bring a stereo in from a car into one of the rooms of Murphy Flood's, which they would have rented. And they would sit around and each week someone would have their choice of music. It was when records were very expensive. And of course, some people had more money than others, more records than others. But and then whose choice was good and whose choice was boring? Who would play German, Lieder? Who would play lovely Beethoven? Who would play Bach? And so that was a great outlet for anyone who was interested in music in Enniscorthy, and I think in many other towns.
I thought it was a wonderful portrait of a period as well. And I felt as well, like if you had grown up where I grew up, you could write something similar about the same kind of, middle class area in Galway City. And also the stuff about Haughey, the civil rights movement, Bloody Sunday, that comes through, that permeates the book and the exchanges that people have. It reminded me so much, perhaps because I'm virtually the same age as you are.
Yeah. I think anyone things, who was
I mean, I can remember my father, God be good to him, saying, that fella Haughey, he's up to no good. But there was a particular mention as well where the British embassy was burned. And I think somebody made the comment, if I can find it here, but burning the British embassy won't help our cause. It will make us look like a crowd of balubas, which was a sentence that really struck me. It had quite an echo because it was a word that was thrown around. I asked her upstairs in the office and nobody knew what
the real
meaning of the word balooba. I was wondering, how would you explain that sentence to your students in Colombia, for instance?
Or a translator, in some language. How would you explain
balubas? Because, we were old enough to remember vaguely when we were kids.
When you come to the Congo, will you come bring your own ammunition and a gun?
Yeah, and there were 9 Irish soldiers murdered or killed by balubas. They were a tribe in the Congo.
That's right.
And it happened, I think, in the early 1960s or thereabouts.
Yeah.
And it was a phrase that was thrown around liberally when we were kids.
Would
you stop behaving like a balooba if you're,
basically
have a bit of manners.
But, that's right.
That would be just one small example of the echoes that are there.
That idea of the North in 68 and 69 exploding came to us via television. So it seemed both remote and near. We were never quite sure which. Do you know what I mean? With Bloody Sunday, that idea of come downstairs, there's something on the television. And God, that's happening in Derry. And I think it made the North and the South feel separate from each other. The fact that it was on television, that it seemed like riots in America. It seemed like something happening elsewhere. The fact that it was, people got to know about it via television. I was trying to register that in the book as well.
Other thing that struck a chord, and I think will strike a chord with a lot of people, is just the sense of thrift that's there throughout that period, and it comes through in the book very strongly as well, that you don't waste money. You think long and hard about spending it, for instance, on something like a record player.
Oh, yeah. And there'd be comment, where her sister towards the end of the book says, well, of course, you have no problem buying records. In other words, people talking about each other is spending of money.
And a thing is only dear the day you buy it.
Well, that was my uncle who genuinely, I think the family I'm talking about, he said that once. And it was now in our side of the family. It was a man that my aunt married, and we were very fond of him. But one day he said that, we had never heard anybody sing a thing is only dear the day you buy it. Sure, we wouldn't buy anything. But I mean, if these water charges had come in then, I can tell you the amount of checking who was going to the bathroom at what time and the amount of water they were using would be a daily watch. There'd be a watch on the bathroom. The door of the bathroom would be locked. From the outside, and so you'd have to get the key to go. I mean, money was scarce and money was watched, and the previous generation had been brought up in such poverty.
People would probably be setting up outside toilets if they didn't have them.
People would often say, God, I went up to your house tonight, but there was no one there. That would be because all the hall light would be turned off, because my mother would say, turn off all those lights we're not using. If you're not using a light, turn it off. And I have friends, I notice, still who would leave a light on. I say, what are you leaving that on for? She, we're not in the room. And they say, I said, what are you talking about? I said, well, in our house, we'd never leave a light on.
One thing that struck me towards the end, I mean, things, it's like in regard to dealing with the grief, they take some time. Obviously, it goes on for maybe 3 years or thereabouts. And then towards the end, Nora decides to move on. I suppose it's the influence of the music, making new friends, that sort of thing. And she goes out. Actually, I want to ask you, sorry, there was the quiz. I thought you were very unkind maybe to the people of Monaghan, right, in the sense that they've suffered enough, but they're portrayed as not being the smartest when it comes to the quizzes.
Yeah, but I think everybody blames her. Do you know, in other words, people of Monaghan just couldn't answer these incredibly. How many symphonies did Bruckner write? Do you know, in other words, I think the joke is on...
I know,
on,
but asking to spell GAA was a question that was suggested.
I think the joke is on the quizmaster there rather than the people of Monaghan or the people of Kilmuckridge, that there was a quizmaster who had these extraordinary questions that nobody knew the answer to.
Yeah, but...
You know,
sorry, and at the end, she decides to, if you like, modernise the house, get a new fireplace, empty out. She's persuaded to empty Morris's clothes out of the wardrobe, have them all taken away, wherever. But then there's an encounter with Morris. It's either sort of a vision, a hallucination. Why that?
That's the hardest thing I've ever done. You know, I remember being in Wexford and thinking, I have to write this now, and I'll go to bed. I'll get up early in the morning. And I remember getting up really early one Saturday morning and saying, today's the day now. I've been thinking about this now for 10 years. You know, I'm going to write that today. And the thing about writing a passage like that, where he almost appears again, is that you can't really revise it. If you get it wrong the first time, you get it wrong. You've got to almost imagine it in real time as though it's happening to you now. So you have to sort of work like that. So I spend the day with it, with the idea that at the end, the reward will be that I can go and have a swim. I can sort of swim it out of myself. But of course, it began to rain outside. But I went down eventually. I did swim, but it was a hard day's work, and I wouldn't like to put myself through it again because I had to... writing is not... You're just making something up. You're actually pretending, what would he say next? What would she say? What would he look like? What would he do now? And you have to do that as though it's happening in the room with you. And it's hard work, you know, I wouldn't put myself through it again.
Why is it in the book?
It's in the book because she needs something just to get herself out, some release. It's almost a release when it happens that he's been living within her, you know, that his death has not registered with her. And he's sort of within her. And it's almost a way of releasing what has happened, letting it out, letting it get said in a way that dreams can do that or that therapy can do that. In this case, almost confronting him, asking him questions, and that sort of is some way out to get into the future. Something has to happen to her to get her to stop living with his death.
But there's one thing that's left hanging is, and it's not resolved, is Connor's future.
Yeah.
It's somehow, there's an expectation of darkness.
Yeah, that, you know, that she's worried, no matter what happens, she's never sure that everyone's going to be all, because of what's happened. The question she keeps asking him is everyone going to be all right? Is everyone going to be okay? And then with that one, he withholds, he doesn't say. And of course, that leaves her with something new to worry about.
Does it give you a new book to write?
Oh, God, I hope not. No, but you never know.
And so it's, as I say, it's quite a wonderful read. That's my personal response to it, Colin. I suspect a lot of book clubs around the country will read and enjoy and maybe argue the toss over it. So what's next? You're doing more than writing your novels.
Yeah, well, I'll go back and teach. I teach in Columbia University one semester every year, so I'll go back and do that in January, and I'll write another novel, a book of stories, and I can't.
Is there much left in your much left to be mired in your family and in your youth and in your background?
There probably
Sorry,
is.
Sorry, did I say mired? I meant mind.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. But there probably is, but I don't know it yet. You know, so somehow, sometime or other, you can just be walking along. Something can, like the novel Brooklyn came to me very quickly, suddenly out of the blue. Where the week before, I would have had no idea I was going to write that. So you just can't tell.
Well, The good news for some listeners who may be in and around the Dublin 2 area is that Colm Tobin will be reading from his new novel, Nora Webster, followed by some audience questions tomorrow at 7 in St. Stephen's Church. That's the Pepper Canister. That's in Mount Street in Dublin 2. Tickets are €12 or €10 for concessions, and you can get further information at dublinwritersfestival.com. Colm, thank you very much indeed for coming to studio. You're always welcome here.
Thank you very much, Sean.
We'll be talking about that Apple letter after the break.
Today with Sean O'Rourke on RTE Radio 1.